You're listening to KRUU LP 100.1 FM, the voices of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. Grassroots, listener-supported, solar-powered radio broadcasting from the Cultural District here in Fairfield, Iowa. And our solar panels are working today, even in the midst of winter. And this is Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley. And my mother really wanted to be here for today's show because she absolutely loves this book, but unfortunately she wasn't able to make it today. We have with us, back for the third time on Writers' Voices, the creator of some of the most interesting books that we see all year. Sean Usher is the founder of the blog-based archives Letters of Note and Lists of Note, which have inspired books of the same name, edited by him. He lives in the UK, and the book that we're talking about today is Letters of Note, Volume 2. Welcome back to Writers' Voices, Sean.
Thanks for having me back. It's always a pleasure.
Well, it's our pleasure, too, and it's especially our pleasure when we get these beautiful books in the mail. I want to just give a shout-out to your publisher, Chronicle Books, who publishes some of the most beautiful books that we see. You know, even if the topic isn't all that interesting, the design of the book almost always is. And in your case...
I know, that's one of the reasons I went with them. I mean, they make such beautiful books.
Yeah.
I mean, as soon as I saw their catalogue, you know, it just seemed like the perfect fit.
Exactly.
Because these books are... These letters of notebooks really are gorgeous objects. So it was really important to find a publisher who takes care when it comes to the design of the books, and that, you know, and doesn't kind of scrimp and save to, you know, to cut corners. So I'm over the moon to be working with them again.
Exactly. Now you publish differently in the UK than you do in the US, don't you?
Yeah, not that unique anymore, but when the first book came out in 2013 in the UK, I crowdfunded the first edition with Unbound, which is essentially like Kickstarter for books. So I asked people to pledge up front before the book was made, which basically meant that I could afford to make the book at my own speed and, you know, not at the behest of a traditional publisher. It made the whole process a little bit more stressful because I had people giving me money up front, and you know, I had people looking over my shoulder all the time waiting for this book to materialize. But it also gave me a lot more freedom when it came to making the book exactly as I wanted it. So it was crowdfunded, the first edition, which was a special edition. And then there was also a trade edition which went into the shops in the UK, which was published by Canongate, which is an independent publishing house in the UK. So I've got two publishers in the UK, and then I've got Chronicle in the US, and then many more. I mean, the first book's been published in 21 languages.
So wow.
I have a whole host of publishers. It's been an amazing journey, and it just, you know, it continues to baffle me, and I pinch myself every single day when I find myself speaking to people like you across the globe. You know,
journey. It's wonderful. Now, with Unbound, are you still using them for the first edition of each new book? Are you still doing the crowdfunding?
Yes, I am, yes. So I've got three books out now, so Letters of Note, Lists of Note, and Volume 2 of Letters of Note, all of which the first editions were crowdfunded with Unbound. My next book I'm working on is Speeches of Note, which you can imagine what the content is. I've been, for the past 4 years... while I've been doing letters and lists, I've also been looking for speeches. You know, not the usual speeches we all know and love, but I've been digging deep for speeches that weren't really heard by that many people, you know, for all different kinds of reasons. Speeches that were written but never made for certain reasons. You know, so I've been really digging deep into archives and papers collections to find these unsung gems.
Wow.
Speeches. That's going to be out. We're doing a special edition through Unbound again, but it won't be crowdfunded. I make my life difficult for some reason, but it makes sense to me. But that, you know, hopefully that'll be out in, it will be out end of next year.
Now, the advantage of Unbound over trying to do this on Kickstarter or something is they actually provide publishing services too, don't they?
Yeah, a lot of people just say, you know, a lot of people say to me, why don't you just use Kickstarter? Because they're much more, you know, they're a much more famous, bigger company. It'll be easier to fund your book through that. Had I done it through Kickstarter, at the end of the process, I just would have been left with a pile of money. And I would have had no help with the publishing side of things. I would have had to, you know, literally self-publish the book. With Unbound, once we've hit our crowdfunding target, Unbound also published the book. So they're half crowdfunding, half publishing house, and they make beautiful, beautiful books. It's run by people who, you know, ex-authors, a guy called John Mitchinson, who used to run the marketing department of Waterstones Books here in the UK. So they are really, really knowledgeable when it comes to books, and they just felt like, I mean, the guy who started the company, Dan, he's had quite a few best-selling books in the UK. But he was just kind of disillusioned with the whole process because he found at the end of that, you know, after 10 years of publishing, or writing rather, these amazing best-selling books, he didn't have any contact with the people that had bought his books. So the idea of Unbound is that I'm indirect, you know, I'm always talking to the people that bought my books.
And I can imagine there's pluses and minuses to that.
Yes, it means I'm always available to people, which on one hand is great because it is lovely to be in touch with everyone that loves what I do. But it does mean that, you know, if they do have to wait a bit longer for their book, it means I get it in the neck, you know, quite rightly, but it's an extra level of stress.
Yes, I'm sure. It's sort of like you're bound to your readers through Unbound.
Yeah, but, you know, that's a good thing, and it
yes.
works to my advantage. So the positives far outweigh the negatives, and it's lovely to be doing something a bit differently, you know, in this day and age. And because, you know, the Letters of Note website has been so popular, something like 120 million people have visited it since 2009.
Oh my gosh!
It means I already have my audience, you know, and I just need to contact the people that visit my website and tell them about the book. I don't need, you know, the big marketing budget of a HarperCollins. To kind of market the book for me, because I've already done that legwork.
Right.
So it's just lovely. It's just lovely to try something new. And Unbound have gone from strength to strength. The first Letters of Note book was one of the first books on Unbound. Since then, they've published, you know, hundreds of books and you know, some best-selling books and critically acclaimed, award-winning books. So it really is lovely to be a part of that. And I adore Unbound so much that I'm now a shareholder in the company.
Well, congratulations.
Yeah, sure.
You know, I think the last time we spoke with Lists of Note, I think you mentioned that Unbound was going to open something in the U.S. for U.S. authors. Do you know if that has happened?
That's still on the cards, and I think next year that's going to happen. It's just taken a bit longer than, you know, hoped, because I think it's because everything was going so well here in the U.K. They kind of focused on the U.K., which fair enough, they didn't want to, you know, run before the war. But now everything is so well established in the U.K., they are certainly trying to do something in the U.S. Next year.
Well, Sean, let's talk a little bit about your website and how that got started. I know we've talked about that before, but some of our listeners probably have not heard the story. What made you decide to start the Letters of Note website?
Well, it was, you have to go back, I can't get this wrong, yes, I can get it wrong actually, but I'm going to guess. It was about 14 years ago when I first met the lady who's now my wife. For the first 10 months of our relationship, she lived hundreds of miles apart because she had to go to Spain for her university course. And for that 10 months, we decided to stay in touch by letter, mainly. We decided to kind of ignore emails and text messages as much as we could and just write old-fashioned letters to each other, you know, for the novelty of it, really. And it was the best possible start we could have had because we were far more open and honest about things, and we got to know each other incredibly well over those 10 months, that by the end of it, we were best friends. We'd fallen in love. And I'd also fallen in love with letter writing and the very concept of letter writing. And it was just kind of a slow burn, really, and I just couldn't get them out of my head, these letters, just generally, and also my wife's letters. So I started reading books about letters, reading collections of letters. I started buying a lot of biographies that back in the day were based on people's letters. I started visiting archives and museums. And it just snowballed, and in 2009, I was in a job that I hated, and to kind of save myself, you know, stop myself from dying of boredom, I just decided to start a website. I couldn't believe a website like this didn't exist already. And I started Letters of Note, on which I feature and kind of discuss a few letters per week that I found through all these various avenues. And it got incredibly popular really, really quickly, and I didn't market it. It was just very, very kind of word of mouth, and it grew in popularity very, very quickly, and I soon had millions of people visiting the website and getting in touch with me and kind of suggesting letters that they know of, that they'd written, that they'd received. And before long, I had this community of people, of, you know, enthusiasts kind of just surrounding me and sending me stuff all the time. So and it's just grown since then. You know, the difficult part now isn't finding the letters. It's kind of sifting through the thousands that I've been sent over the years. So it's been incredible. Then the books came out, and then it's also kind of evolved into a live event show. We do something called Letters Live, where we get people up on stage, people like Benedict Cumberbatch and Jude Law, get them up on stage to read letters from the books and from the website and other letters that I found just for the live shows, and we've done that to thousands of people, and next year we're bringing that to the US as well. So
now, is that a one-time event, or does it play for a few weeks?
So what we do is we do one-off shows, and we also do like twice a year we do runs of shows. So we do 5 nights in London.
Oh wow.
Yeah. And we play to like 1500 people each night. And Benedict Cumberbatch is a partner in the company Letters Live, which is incredibly lucky for us. And, you know, it makes the job a lot easier, getting amazing talent on stage when you have Benedict Cumberbatch on board.
I would think so, yes.
So, yeah, we're going to do that next year in the US. We're doing one in LA, the week of the Oscars. That's on February 22nd, which will have an amazing cast. And we're going to hopefully do a run in New York later on in the year. So we're just kind of spreading our wings at the minute, and that's been going since 2013 when the first book came out. We did it at first it was like a launch party for the first book when that came out in the UK. We decided to just get a few people up on letters. We had no idea it was going to become like a regular event, but it just went so well that we thought, how can we just leave it there? You know, it's such a unique event, but such a simple one as well. You wonder why people haven't done it before. All the best ideas are the simple ones. So we've got a website, book, and live events at the minute.
And what's next?
What's next? Well, I'm doing Speeches of Note.
That's right.
I'm doing a website, which I'm launching in the next few weeks.
Wow.
That will be a book as well that comes out next year. I imagine that will become some kind of live event as well, because speeches just naturally just lend themselves to the stage. And then after that, I'm going to do a love letters book, a love letters of note, which I've been preparing for quite a while. I've always got a few things on the boil. I can't just work on one thing at once. It means if I get bored of something, I can just switch to the other project.
Well, I would imagine by this time you're not doing the websites all by yourself.
Yeah, I am, yeah.
You are?
I'm a bit of a control freak. I it would make my life so much easier if I could just give up control of stuff and kind of employ someone to do certain things for me, like the website. But I'm just incredibly anal about stuff, and I just imagining someone else doing these things for me kind of, makes me nervous.
I can't
imagine.
So
I just do them myself and tire myself out mentally. But it's for the. I imagine one day I'm going to have to give up some kind of control and get someone to do that kind of stuff for me, because it's not sustainable at this rate.
You know, last week on Writers' Voices, we interviewed another Chronicle author, Danielle Crissa, and her book, Your Inner Critic is a Great Big Jerk. And she started with the website, The Jealous Curator, where she was curating modern art, and it really took off. And she was really just doing it for herself, but it really took off. And so we had a discussion about curation, and I think really that's what you are too. You're a curator.
Yeah, that's essentially what I do. That's the part of the job that I love the most. You know, as it's always the same, isn't it? When things like this become popular, you have less and less time to do the thing that got you to that point, you know. So
yeah,
it stays up because I'm so busy with the live stuff and the, you know, the book and the promotion and all that kind of stuff. I have less time to curate and kind of and search for these letters, because that's the one, you know, that's the part of the job that I absolutely adore, and that's what got me here. And I'm the same, you know. I did, when I first started this in 2009, I was doing it for myself. It was a hobby.
Mm-hmm.
Had it not become popular and successful, I would still be doing it right now. I'm absolutely certain of that fact, because it's just a part of me now, and it's an urge, it's an uncontrollable urge. But yeah, I'm not hoping that you know, things will settle down soon and I can get back to that part of it, because there's nothing quite like it. You know, finding a letter that's not been read by many people and putting it on the website or putting it in the book, it's like a natural high. It's an odd feeling.
Why do you think there's such a desire for people to have someone curate things for them? And, you know, why you have become so popular, you know, your site has become so popular in doing that. Have you ever thought about sort of the sociological implications of that?
I think Letters of Note took off for quite a few reasons. I think it was like the perfect storm, really. I think you know, everyone was suddenly sending emails and text messages and tweets, and everything was becoming digitized, and letters were kind of a novelty. You know, many kids these days don't even understand what a letter is, you know, like an old-fashioned letter. I speak to quite a few kids and they have no idea. So when they look at these amazing, you know, handwritten, sometimes illustrated letters, it's like looking at a piece of, like a piece of treasure or something. So there's that part of it. There's also the fact that these are very easily digestible, because it's all, you know, each letter is its own story. It's like a self-contained story, and they're so easy to digest. Some of them, you know, it just takes a couple of minutes to read the introduction for a bit of context, and then the letter itself. We short attention spans these days. That to kind of digest these is incredibly easy. So that, you know, that helps.
Mm.
And people love curators because it saves them legwork, you know.
Right.
There are so many collections of letters out. You know, there's selected letters of, I don't know, Ernest Hemingway. The selected letters of Virginia Woolf. What I do is kind of search through these sometimes dense collections and just pick out the gems, you know, the very best, and to put all them in a collection of all the best letters from all these individual sources is it's the greatest hits, isn't it? It's like a best of.
Right, like a mixtape.
Exactly, yeah, it is exactly like a mixtape. Sometimes I do feel a bit like a DJ, kind of putting these books out. But yeah, there are so many different reasons why. And then the live events have also taken off, and that the attraction to that is, well, one, it's unique. Two, these letters are written most of the time as, you know, just between one person and another. You very rarely expect your letters to be read by someone other than the recipient. So they are incredibly private, and you get to see people at their most kind of guarded and natural. These are people in their natural state, you know. It's just a very good way to learn about people or certain moments in history. And I just think humans are naturally nosy, you know, and not rude, but we're naturally nosy about our fellow
oh,
humans.
Oh, yeah.
And this is like a legitimate form of snooping. So to see those private letters read out on stage by famous people, it's just, you couldn't ask for a better marriage, really.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
You're listening to Writer's Voices, and our guest today is Sean Usher, author of, or not exactly author, but compiler, curator of Letters of Note, Volume 2, an eclectic collection of correspondence deserving of a wider audience. How many letters are in this book?
There's 122.
Okay.
I should know that, shouldn't I? I think it's 122, yeah.
And how many letters do you have on the website now?
I think there's about 1,200. About 1,200. But again, because I've been so busy recently with the books and the live shows, I've not really updated the website much recently. But, it stands on its own as a, you know, as an archive of letters, it doesn't bother me so much that I can't update it at the moment, because it, you know, you can there's still so much there to enjoy. It's funny you should say. We just had a problem kind of explaining what I do. When people ask me what I do, I really find it difficult to describe my job, because I'm not an author. I don't write fiction. I write the intros in the books,
which are in some cases my favorite part. Honestly, I mean.
Oh, that's nice to hear.
they put the letters in context, and it's a very important part of the book. If you just had the letters without the intros, it wouldn't work.
As I said, there are so many collections of letters out there already published, but quite a lot of them, there's no context, and it really is just a chronological, you know, selection of people's letters, and I find it quite difficult to immerse myself in that, you know, without some kind of introduction to each letter, or at least each, you know, grouping of letters.
Now, one of the things I've noticed is
the difficult part. I've always made an effort to introduce these letters as briefly as possible and concisely as possible, because I'm very aware that it's easy to kind of lose people before they've got to the letter. You know, I just want to give people enough context to enjoy the letter, but not too much so much that I bore people before they get to the meat.
Now, one thing that you don't do, which I could think that some people, if they had embarked on this project, might have gone in this other direction. You don't sort of group the letters thematically.
Yeah, because I think it's not too easy, actually. I just think it's... I love the fact that it's a roller coaster ride. You never know what you're going to get next. It's like having a mixtape, you know. Mm-hmm. You've got to trust the person that made that tape to take you on a journey, like an emotional journey. And that's exactly what the books are like. I mean, they may look randomly arranged, but it's, you know, I spend a lot like weeks just kind of arranging them and working out what order to put them in, so that, you know, there's kind of spikes, there's highs and lows, there's you know, sad letters followed by funny letters. Some of them have a kind of, they are themed in a way, so you'll have a letter about some kind of moment in history, and then another letter from a moment in history just, you know, a few years later, but it's quite vague, but it's carefully crafted, but it's also meant to look quite random. I think, and also if I'd have put it into chapters, say love letters, then, you know, political letters, rejection letters, there's a chance that you're going to ignore a certain chapter because you think you're not going to like that particular type of letter. The way I've grouped them now, you know, non-thematically, there's more chance that everyone's going to read, you know, pretty much all of the letters.
Right.
So that's
I never thought about that. Now, the letters, many of the letters are from or to famous people, but not all of them. And how do you balance that? You know, whether, you know, to include, how do you decide to include a letter from someone that no one's heard of?
It's the same with all the letters, really. If I read a letter and it provokes a strong emotional response in me, then I consider that worthy of a book like this, or even just the website. If I can set it up in a couple of paragraphs, then I'll use it. There are so many letters that I adore, you know, but which I wouldn't put in a book like this, because you need so much context to enjoy the letter or even just appreciate it. There's books like, you know, the Mitford sisters. There's an amazing book of all their letters, these sisters that wrote to each other constantly throughout their lives. But I would never put one of those letters in these books, because you can't enjoy one of those letters without the rest of them. You know, you have to enjoy those letters in their entirety. So to put one of those letters in one of these books just wouldn't really make much sense, and it wouldn't do any justice to the letter. If the letter stands on its own and provokes an emotional response in me and kind of speaks to me in some way, then I'll consider it, you know, famous or otherwise. In fact, it's more exciting for me to find a fascinating letter written by someone that isn't famous. You know, we hear about famous people all the time. To read a letter by someone that was you know, one of us,
right,
non-famous, is more interesting in many ways.
Do you have people sending you letters every day?
Not every day. Every week, yeah.
Every week.
I've got an address on my website, a postal address that people can just, you know, send stuff to, and I've got a lot of stuff. I've got a lot of letters that have been sent to me, and it's fascinating. I get a lot of letters from people who say that the most common type of letter I get sent is letters from people that were at war. So people
right.
write to me and say, my granddad was in the war, and he wrote this beautiful letter back to my grandma when he was, you know, in on the field, and you know, I'd just love you to see a copy of it. So I've got hundreds and hundreds of these letters written during the war that are always kind of heartbreaking, but because I have seen so many of them, it's difficult to put them in a book like this. It's difficult, and so sadly, I have to write quite a few tactful rejection letters to people who have sent me letters that I can't use. So it's amazing, but it's also quite sad at times.
Well, every time I talk to you, I think I should send you a copy of some of these letters. We have a whole trove of family letters from the 1800s.
Oh, really? In fact, I think I remember you saying this last time.
Yeah. And from some of them are from the Civil War, but the interesting thing is he actually talks about various battles that you've read about in history. So
that's incredible. Yeah.
He was on a hospital ship outside the Battle of Vicksburg and could hear that whole battle going on.
Amazing.
Yeah.
And what a lovely thing to be able to see, you know, the handwriting. So that's a direct link to the past, just knowing that person held that letter and wrote it with their own hand. I mean, it's just such an amazing connection to the past. And this is what we're losing, you know, as we send emails and Facebook messages that are all pixels, and you know, they're so impersonal that we're not going to be. We're losing our history as we become digitized.
Yeah. Do you still write handwritten letters?
I do. Yeah. I try to as much as possible. Not as much as I should. You know, I kick myself every time I write an email because I know that. Unless it's a business email, but I know that the person receiving it isn't going to appreciate it or enjoy it as much as they would have had I, you know, just spent a few more minutes writing or just getting out a typewriter and typing a letter. It's more enjoyable for me, and it's also more enjoyable for the person that receives it. Just you know, not even before you've opened a letter that's been handwritten, just, you know, looking at the envelope and knowing that there's a handwritten letter in there, it's such a...
Yeah.
Boost, I think. It's a great way to start the day.
Yeah, it is. Of course, the downside is if you need to communicate quickly, sending by post
doesn't really work.
But
I just think we survived back in the day like that, you know. I think we're in too much of a rush these days. There's too much of a hurry.
You know, you're right. There was a
if you don't reply to an email within a day, people think you've died. You know, it's like,
I know.
Just calm down.
I know.
At least give me a couple of days to reply.
I know. And, you know, 30 years ago in business, I couldn't imagine why I would ever need a fax machine. You know, when they were first coming out, I thought, what would I need that for? And now, now they're obsolete.
I know. And apparently emails are on the way out too. I read a piece the other week in the Atlantic that said that less and less people are using emails because everyone's on Facebook, and it's far quicker to send a Facebook message and far more user-friendly. So people have, especially younger people, aren't even emailing anymore, which is incredible to me. You know, emails still seem quite fresh in my mind. apparently they're on the way out as well.
I think you're right. I mean, in business communications, I try and use Skype messaging or another messaging form because it's quicker.
Exactly. And, you know, what's great is that we're communicating more than ever. You know, we are sending so many messages to people. We're so connected to others.
Yeah.
And it's fantastic, and we're instantly connected to people. But we're doing it in such a way that it's all fragmented. We're sending little messages here, little messages there, all through different kind of means. We use, you know, Facebook, text message, tweets, Skype, and it's such a mess. You know?
Yes, and like you said, how are historians going to dig through all of that to find...
It's just not not going to happen. You know? I mean, there's the Harry Ransom Center there in the U.S. It's in Texas, isn't it? Yeah, it's in Texas. They've started buying up email accounts of famous people. They bought Salman Rushdie's email account, so you can go into the Harry Ransom Center and sit down at a computer and look through his email inbox as if you were.
Oh my goodness,
Salman Rushdie. And it's incredible, you know, so it is being done. You know, people are collecting email accounts, but it's only ever for famous people, you know.
Wow.
The average Joe isn't going to have their emails kind of archived by, you know, clever people. They're just going to be lost to time.
Wow.
And it's terribly sad.
You're listening to Writers' Voices, and our guest today is Sean Usher. The book we're discussing is Letters of Note, Volume 2, an eclectic collection of correspondence deserving of a wider audience. Sean, do you have a favorite letter other than the ones from your wife?
Oh, yeah, that's what I would have said, obviously. it's like choosing a favorite child. I don't really know. I think in this new book, there's a letter that's in the center pages. If you open the center pages, it's like a fold-out. I think it spans something like 8 pages, and it's the most enormous letter you've ever seen. And I think it's possibly the longest gatefold ever put into a book. And it was a hand-sewn letter sewn by a lady called Lorena Bulwer. And she was having mental difficulties. She was in a home, and she used to hand-embroider these kind of biographical but quite difficult-to-understand letters that spoke of her family and Queen Victoria, just as she was kind of losing her mind. And it's just the most incredible object. And in real life, it's 12 foot long.
Oh, my goodness.
I wanted to kind of keep it in one piece, so we did this huge gatefold. To get that in the book, it was a technical nightmare, logistical nightmare. But I'm so glad we made the effort, because it's the most unique letter I could think of putting in the book. And it's such an amazing centerpiece.
I'm looking. Oh, wow. Yeah. This is embroidered, you said?
Hand embroidered, yeah. So it took a month to embroider that.
Wow.
Transcribing it was quite a job, because a lot of it's slightly illegible. So transcribing that letter was a task, a very enjoyable task, but it took a long time. So just to embroider it must have. Goodness me, it must have been. She had the spare time.
Yeah. That you mentioned earlier that that the Letters of Note has been published in 21 languages, I think is what you said.
Yeah, the first book.
The first book. And I was thinking how difficult it would be to be the translator, because the letters come from so many different periods of history where an English changes.
It does, yeah, which is why you have to trust that foreign publisher to get someone
who can
to translate it. What I love about some of the editions, the German publishers, when they translate my books, they get a different person to do each letter. So for the first book, there's like dozens and dozens of translators have worked on it. So you get these different translators' voices for each letter, which I think is a great way to do it. And they assign different letters to different translators based on their background and what they've, you know, what field of work they've been in, which I think is a great way to do it. But you're right, it's frustrating that I will never know how it's been translated, because I can only speak English and a bit of Welsh.
Now,
I will never know how well they've been translated, but you just have to kind of trust your publisher.
Do you include any letters that were originally in a different language and you translate them into English for the book?
There are not that many, but there are a few, and I don't personally translate them, obviously. what we usually do is use an existing translation. The letters have usually been published at some point in another book and translated, so we either use that publisher's translation or get an archivist to translate it for us. So it's very rare that happens, to be honest. I mean, this is a very... It's a very Western book. It's a very Western collection of letters. It's the website as well, because that's all I know.
Do you think anyone's doing this in, like...
To include a lot of letters from in foreign languages.
Do you think anyone's doing this in Asia or in, other parts of the world, doing something similar to what you're doing?
I'm sure they are. I hope they are. I really hope they are. I'm not aware of any books like this in foreign languages, but I would be very surprised if it wasn't happening.
Wow.
Especially somewhere like China.
Yes.
It's such a populous country. Yeah. It would be quite depressing were they not.
Yeah, really.
Not something similar over there. I know that we're looking to take letters live to China, which would be amazing. So there's nothing quite like that in China, but I'm sure there must be books like letters in there. I hope so.
Well, Sean, why don't you share a letter or two with our listeners today?
I'd love to, yeah. Do you have any in mind, or do you want me to just pick some?
Well, you know, my mother, like I said, she was very disappointed that she wasn't able to be here today, and she had little check marks beside a few books, a few letters here. So,
okay.
Let me see. Let's see. Oh, how about Samuel Clemens to Orion Clemens, the newfangled writing machine?
Oh, that's a fantastic letter as well. So this was in 1874, and it's Mark Twain, Samuel Clemens, was writing to his brother, and he wrote this letter. Well, he typed it on his first ever typewriter, and it's just it's so, so charming. And I found the original letter as well. So in the book, you can see this hand, this typed letter of Mark Twain. This is his first ever typed letter, and at the top there's just a load of letters. You can see he's just been testing the keys. There's BJUYTKI. Makes absolutely no sense, but it's just really, really charming. He writes to his brother, "Dear brother, I'm trying to get the hang of this newfangled writing machine, but I'm not making a shining success of it. However, this is the first attempt I have ever made, and yet I perceive that I shall soon and easily acquire a fine facility in its use. I saw the thing in Boston the other day and was greatly taken with it. Susie has struck the keys once or twice and no doubt has printed some letters which do not belong where she put them. The having been a compositor is likely to be a great help to me, since one chiefly needs swiftness in banging the keys. The machine costs $125. The machine has several virtues. I believe it will print faster than I can write. One may lean back in his chair and work it. It piles an awful stack of words on one page. It don't muss things on scatter ink blots around. Of course it saves paper. Susie is gone now, and I fancy I shall make better progress. Working this typewriter reminds me of old Robert Buchanan, who, you remember, used to set up articles at the case without previously putting them in the form of manuscript. Yeah. I was lost in admiration of such marvelous intellectual capacity. Love to Molly, your brother Sam." It's just incredibly charming. But I love the fact that, and this is a great thing about being able to look at old letters. You can see he's ripped, I think the page has been ripped, and you can see where he's taped it across the page. It's just such a charming thing.
Now, you do often have pictures of the original letter in the book, or sometimes even just the letter and not a depending on the writing and so forth. Sometimes you have a typewritten version and the original letter, and sometimes you have just the original letter. And if you don't have a picture of the letter, does that mean that you did not have access to it?
It means that I've tried with all my might to find the original letter to get a picture of it, but I failed for some reason. Or I found a picture of it that wasn't good enough quality, or I found, or it's just been completely illegible, you know, to the point where it's just, there's no point putting it on there. But, you know, 99% of the time, if I can find the original letter, then I'll put it in the book, because it adds another dimension to the whole experience. And, you know, even if it's not particularly legible, then it's worth having on there. You know, as we were saying, it's a connection to the past, and it just makes it, being able to see the paper someone's chosen, being able to see the mistakes they've made or the smudges, or, you know, at the top of Mark Twain's letter, that line of letters where he's just been practicing the keys, it just adds so much to the experience. So I try really hard, and a lot of my time is taken up, you know, trying to find these original documents, to bring them to life.
Mm. Another one that Caroline had checked was "I Have Resolved to Escape" from Winston Churchill. Would you like to read that one?
This is one of my favorites. This is one of the politest letters I've ever seen. So this was in 1899, and Winston Churchill, he was 24 years old at the time, and he was a war correspondent in the Second Boer War. And he was captured, so he was imprisoned. And he wrote this letter. He fled. He escaped. But before he did, he wrote this very polite letter to Louis de Souza, basically saying, you know, I'm on my way. I'm escaping. But it's so politely written. And on the envelope that the letter was in, it said PPC on it, which means to take leave. Just this very kind of it's just so polite. And I'll read a bit of it. It says, it's written in the state school's prison. Dear Mr. de Souza, I do not consider that your government was justified in holding me, a press correspondent and a non-combatant, as a prisoner, and I have consequently resolved to escape. The arrangements I have succeeded in making, in conjunction with my friends outside, are such as give me every confidence. But I wish in leaving you thus hastily and unceremoniously to once more place on record my appreciation of the kindness which has been shown me and the other prisoners by you, by the commandment and by Dr. Gunning, and my admiration of the chivalrous and humane character of the Republican forces. It's just so fantastic. And at the end he says, regretting the circumstances have not permitted me to bid you a personal farewell, believe me, yours very sincerely, Winston S. Churchill, December 11th, 1899. I could have done a, you know, Winston Churchill letters of note. He wrote so many incredible letters. He was so very eloquent and just dignified in his letters. And this is the perfect kind of example. You know, to be a prisoner and write a letter like that is something else.
Was it meant sincerely, or was any of it tongue in cheek?
I like to think it was tongue in cheek, but we'll never know really. And I've tried to find out whether it was, and no one seems to know. But, you know, knowing Winston Churchill, but I would be very surprised if it wasn't tongue-in-cheek. He had a very good sense of humour, you know, even at 24, even imprisoned. So I imagine it's a bit of both.
All right. Well, let's have one more. Let's see. We Can Change the World. John Lennon to Eric Clapton.
This is, again, I could have written a book just about John Lennon's letters. But this was written by John Lennon to Eric Clapton. And it's essentially John Lennon, 1969, John Lennon writing to Eric Clapton and asking him to form a supergroup. So it's just the most amazing, you know, behind-the-scenes look at two of the most famous musicians in the world. And, yeah, it's eight pages as well. I mean, it goes on and on, and it's a handwritten letter, which makes it even more enjoyable to look at, and yeah, he wanted to get Eric Clapton on board in his supergroup, and you know it worked to an extent because Eric Clapton did join the Plastic Ono Band, which is the name of the band that did form, and he very briefly joined the band, and yeah, it's just fascinating. What I love about John Lennon's letters is that, well, actually, John Lennon and Yoko Ono, whenever Yoko Ono wrote to someone, John Lennon would always be a PS at the bottom. And it would say, I agree, and then signed by John Lennon. So John Lennon used to kind of co-sign all of Yoko's letters. that's nothing to do with this letter, but it's just interesting. But yeah, this is basically a fascinating look at the music industry, you know, two of the most famous people on earth.
Wow. Are there people who collect letters as an investment?
Yes, and there's a lot of money in it. Some of these letters I find at auction houses. So I visit auction houses, or I'm a member of their websites. So every time an interesting letter comes up for sale on auction websites. In fact, this letter was sold at auction. This John Lennon letter for a lot of money. I can't remember how much exactly. So these auction houses are an amazing way to find, you know, previously unpublished letters, and I found quite a few.
But you don't actually buy them.
Sorry?
You don't actually buy them.
I've bought some.
Have you?
And it became a problem because it was so addictive, and because they cost so much money that I had to stop myself. So I had to go cold turkey and just stop visiting these auction websites because I just ended up buying them, and they cost thousands of pounds, and I can't afford it. But there's a letter in the first Letters of Note book by Francis Crick. Just after he co-discovered the structure of DNA, he wrote to his son and said, I've made this most amazing discovery, and he, he wrote this amazing letter about DNA and drew a picture of the structure of DNA, just the most amazing letter of such an incredible, important moment in history. And that was sold, just before the book came out, that was sold at auction for £5 million, and it was the most expensive letter ever sold at auction. So there's huge money in these letters, or some of them anyway. I had to stop.
You become aware of these letters, like if someone, like the John Lennon one, I'm assuming you didn't buy that one. And
no, God no.
But then how do you approach the owner, and is it, you know, do people ever turn you down at putting the letters on your website or in the book?
Yeah, sometimes, yeah. John Lennon's, I speak to Yoko Ono's lawyer, and she's very happy for these letters to be used, as long as, you know, I think we donate some money to their foundation, which is lovely. Lovely thing to do. Mm-hmm. But yeah, some people don't allow us to use their letters. Stephen King, there's an amazing Stephen King letter that was written. In fact, it's my favorite ever letter. This, to answer your earlier question, my favorite ever letter is a letter that I can't publish because Stephen King won't let me. and it was written when he was, I think he was 20, and there was a snowstorm in his town in the U.S., and he wrote to his friend, and in a way that only Stephen King could, even before he was famous, he just described this snowstorm over a few pages in the most chilling, beautiful, just the most evocative way, and it's the most incredible letter, and it gives you chills, and it's quite, but it's also poetic, and it's just beautiful. I've tried and failed to get that on the website and in the books.
Why won't he give you permission?
I don't know. I know he's quite defensive about things he wrote when he was younger, which is, you know, it's fair enough. But I will continue to try. I think I'm going to badger him as long as I live.
So in the case of, like, the John Lennon letter that had been sold at auction, it was, but it's still Yoko who has the rights in terms of publication of that letter and not the owner of the physical letter? Is that how it works?
It depends what you want to do. So for every letter that's in this book, I need permission from the person that wrote the letter. If they've since died, then from their estate. So in John Lennon's case, Yoko Ono controls John Lennon's estate, so I need to get permission from her. And if I want to include a picture of the letter, then I need permission from the person that took the picture, not the person that owns the letter, but the person that took the picture. In this case, it was the auction house, so I simply wrote to the auction house and asked for permission, and they granted it. So for each letter that's in the book, I need, if there's a picture of the letter as well, I need permission from two people to get that letter in the book, which is why a book like this with 120 something letters in it, it's a logistical nightmare.
Absolutely.
Getting hundreds of permissions for these letters, so that's, you know, much of my time is spent.
Now, do you have to get permissions, those same permissions, to put the letters on your website?
Yeah, all the same. Yeah.
All the same?
But it's easier with the website for some reason. It's far easier to get permission. There are occasions where, like if a letter's been all over the internet and it's kind of public knowledge, then yeah, I might just put it on the website anyway. And, you know, if it's not kind of scandalous, or I'll put it on the website and because it's so widely disseminated that it's almost public property. But, you know, legally that isn't the case. But, I still have to get permission for the website as well. But, I mean, also, it's a difficult thing. It's time-consuming, but it also puts me in touch with people that are loosely connected to the letters as well, you know? So it means that I do get to come into contact with Yoko Ono, or even Yoko Ono's lawyer or her estate, which is great because I can ask certain questions about the letters that I wouldn't have, you know, been able to ask had I not got permission, which I can't do that anyway. So.
Now, how long after someone has died does their estate no longer control the letters? For example, you've got letters from Emily Dickinson. Did you have to go to Emily Dickinson's estate to get permission to print that letter?
No, I didn't. So, this is also very complicated because it depends on the country in which the letter was written, or in some cases, the country in which the estate exists. So, It's usually about 60 or 70 years after that, after the person has died, that's when you can use those letters.
They become public domain at that point.
It becomes public domain, yeah. But there are also, it's also not that simple, because if the letter was previously unpublished, then there's another set of rules. So, I mean, there are so many, it's so complicated.
How did you learn all this?
Through trial and error. You know, even 7 years later, it still confuses me, which is, you know, making these books isn't for the weak-willed. You know, it's quite a process. But it, you know, it varies from country to country as well.
I'd expect when
it varies depending on whether when the book was published and whether, like, some estates can extend their copyright period. So, you know, certain estates, even though that person's been dead more than 60 or 70 years, they still have copyright protection on those letters because of, you know, certain loopholes in the law that they've managed to navigate well. It's very, very complicated, and it's the bane of my life.
Well, here's a letter I like from Eleanor Roosevelt to the Daughters of the American Revolution. Would you like to read that one?
Sure, yeah. Let me just get it in front of me. Here we go, let me... Okay, right, got it. This was 1939, and Marian Anderson, the fantastic singer, was... She's African-American. She wasn't allowed to perform at the Daughters of the American Revolution, of which Eleanor Roosevelt was a member. Eleanor Roosevelt, and, you know, this was 1939, this was quite a brave thing to do at that time. She was the first lady. She wrote to the organization and resigned because of this kind of, this essentially what was racism. She wrote to them and said, you know, this is unacceptable. And then she invited Marian Anderson to sing in front of the Lincoln Memorial. And, you know, I think it was 70,000 people attended to watch this this amazing singer. But I'll read it. February 26, 1939, my dear Mrs. Henry M. Robert, Jr., I am afraid that I have never been a very useful member of the Daughters of the American Revolution, so I know it will make very little difference to you whether I resign or whether I continue to be a member of your organization. However, I am in complete disagreement with the attitude taken in refusing Constitution Hall to a great artist. You have set an example which seems to me unfortunate, and I feel obliged to send in to you my resignation. You had an opportunity to lead in an enlightened way, and it seems to me that your organization has failed. I realize that many people will not agree with me, but feeling as I do, this seems to me the only proper procedure to follow. Very sincerely yours, Eleanor Roosevelt. It's just a fantastic, eloquent, kind of very, you know, dignified and principled letter to write. But again, this was 1939, so, you know, she's quite a kind of... very ahead of her time.
Very progressive. How did you come upon...
That's the word I was thinking of.
How did you come upon this letter? How did you find this one?
That's actually quite a famous letter. So I'd heard of that a long time ago. It's in a couple of other collections of letters that I've got on my bookshelf. It was an easy one. And it's, you know, it's out of copyright as well. Slam dunk, really. It's just a shame I couldn't find the original letter. But instead, we've got a beautiful picture of Marianne, which is lovely.
Another fun one is from Gene Wilder to Mel Stewart. Now, Gene Wilder, of course, passed away this past year. And also, he attended the University of Iowa, which is in Iowa City, about an hour's drive from here, at the same time as my mother. And was in a theater class with my mother. However, my mother does not remember him, but another person who was in their theater class, who was my father's college roommate at Cornell and then did a master's degree at the University of Iowa, tells me that Gene Wilder was in their theater class. So I'm believing him.
Wow. That's great.
I know. So, tell us a little bit about this letter.
Well, this letter, in fact, in the U.S. edition of the book, this letter is actually in the book, isn't it? But in the U.K. edition, what we did is because it's a letter written when he was before he filmed Willy Wonka, and it's about the film. So, what we did in the U.K. here is we added the letter as a kind of an insert, and we put it in a golden envelope, and it looked like a golden ticket in the U.K.
Oh, how cool.
Yeah, it's a great thing to do. But I love the fact that it's actually in the book properly.
Yeah.
Yes. But this was in 1970, and Gene Wilder wrote to the director of Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory, Mel Stewart, and just gave his opinion on the on Willy Wonka's costume. And it's just such a... I just love the fact that he's so invested in this character that he's... And so eloquent when he describes the pocket and what he thinks of it and, you know, how it should be. I'll read some of it. Dear Mel, I've just received the costume sketches. I'll tell you everything I think without censoring, and you take my opinion from my opinion what you like. I assume that the designer took his impressions from the book and didn't know, naturally, who would be playing Willy. And I think for a character in general, they're lovely sketches. I love the main thing, the velvet jacket, and I mean to show by my sketch the exact same colour. But I've added two large pockets to take away from the svelte feminine line. I also think the vest is both appropriate and lovely, and I love the same white flowing shirt and the white gloves, also the lighter coloured inner silk lining of the jacket. What I don't like is the precise pinpointing in place and time as this costume does. I don't think of Willy as an eccentric who holds on to his 1912 dandy Sunday suit and wears it in 1970, but rather as just an eccentric, where there's no telling what he'll do or where he ever found his get-up, except that it strangely fits him. Part of this world, part of another. A vain man who knows colours that suit him, yet, with all the oddity, has strangely good taste, something mysterious yet undefined. I'm not a ballet master who skips along with little mincy steps, so as you see, I've suggested ditching the Robert Helpman trousers. Jodhpurs to me belong more to a dancing master. But once elegant, now almost baggy trousers, baggy through preoccupation with more important things, is character. Slime green trousers are icky, but sand-coloured trousers are just as unobtrusive for your camera, but tasteful. The hat is terrific, but making it 2 inches shorter would make it more special. Also, a light blue felt hat band to match with the same light blue fluffy bow tie shows a man who knows how to compliment his blue eyes. To match the shoes with the jacket is Faye. To match the shoes with the hat is taste. Hope all is well. Talk to you soon.
Oh, that's a wonderful letter. And
lovely, yeah. It's a really gorgeous letter. It's also very pleasing to get it in the book. I mean, he's passed away, which is desperately sad, but yeah. It took me a long time to get permission to put this letter in the book. He did refuse initially. I tried to get it in the first book, the first volume, a few years ago, but he refused. And then he saw a copy of the first book, and when I was trying to get it into the second book, because he'd seen how beautiful the first book was.
Oh, wonderful.
So that was really...
Wonderful. Well, Sean, thank you. We're out of time. The hour just flies by. Letters of Note, Volume 2, a great Christmas present. And I'm really looking forward to Speeches of Note as well.
Me too.
All right. And have a happy holiday and stay warm. And I hope you get all your Christmas shopping done.
You too. So nice to talk to you. And no doubt I'll speak to you next year.
I'm looking forward to it. And stay tuned now if you're listening to us on Friday for Planet Earthwild. We rebroadcast the show Monday morning at 8 a.m. And see you next week on Writer's Voices. Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline is a production of KRUU-LP 100.1 FM, produced by Monica Hadley and James Moore. Archives available on KRUUFM.com and writersvoices.com.